This morning, you see there in your bulletin, the passage for today is out of Psalm 121. In many ways, a very personal psalm, a psalm that has meant a lot to me, a psalm that has meant a lot to my family over the past year. And since you guys are family, you know, I feel like you guys should be in on it as well. So I'm just going to go ahead and I'm going to read Psalm 21 right here to start off. And I'm going to read it kind of as like a prayer over you all. A prayer over you all, a prayer over this service, and a prayer that really everything that you hear is something that you can grasp a hold of, something that you can make yours, something that you can confidently stand on. Psalm 121, and then I'm just going to introduce it. I'm not going to have time to go through all of it, but we're going to introduce it, bear witness to how it addresses and its attitude toward the heaviness in life, and how we can be lifted up as a result. So this is Psalm 121. Psalm 121, a song of ascents. I lift up my eyes to the mountains. Where does my help come from? My help comes from the Lord, the maker of heaven and earth. He will not let your foot slip. He who watches over you will not slumber. Indeed, he who watches over Israel will neither slumber nor sleep. The Lord watches over you. The Lord is your shade at your right hand. The sun will not harm you by day, nor the moon by night. The Lord will keep you from all harm and evil. He will watch over your life. The Lord will watch over your coming and going, both now and forevermore. Really just a wealth of wonderful promises there in Psalm 121. Where does my help come from? My help comes from the Lord, the one who made everything. He will not let your foot slip. Yes, there will be instability in life. Yes, there will be times where you are uncertain as to what the next step is. Yes, there will be moments where it feels like the ground beneath you is shaking. But friends, God will never allow you to slide to a place that you can't get back up from. He who watches over you will never slumber. That not even for a second is God disinterested. Not even for a second is he taking a break. Not even for a second is he far off or distant. But he is constantly attentive to you and your situation. Indeed, he who watches over Israel will neither slumber nor sleep. That not only is God's mercy and his grace so big that you can build your life on it, but his mercy, his grace, his wonderful power and might is wide enough for the entirety of the people of God. Nobody is left out of these promises. The Lord watches over you. The Lord is your shade at your right hand. The sun will not harm you by day, nor the moon by night. And of course, in the ancient world, the sun and the moon were associated with the spiritual forces. So for an example, on a really hot day, and where you're just being beaten down by the sun, or a long dry season, it was thought that the sun god was angry. And the moon was often associated with many psychological issues, whether it's epilepsy, memory loss, or even what we would call possession was associated with the moon. And it was thought that had you suffered, had you been afflicted by the sun or the moon, that you were under the power of some spiritual force. Not for the people of God do the spiritual forces ever have the final say over our lives. The Lord will keep you from all harm. He will watch you. He will watch over you as you go through evil. Yes, you will have to walk through the valley of the shadow of death. Yes, there is the assumption of the Christian life that on all sides you will be under attack. You will face things. Things will come up that you didn't expect, that you didn't want to happen. But again, the Lord will never allow any power of evil to have the final say over you. The Lord will watch over your coming and your going, both now and forevermore. You know, normally when you go in and out of somebody's house, you've gone in and out of their presence. But with the Lord, your coming and your going are always in his presence from now and forevermore. Not today was a really good day, but I have to wake up tomorrow and make sure I have things figured out to count on this promise. No, from now forevermore, these promises stand. And, you know, we can kind of come to a psalm like this and immediately, you know, these beautiful scenic images kind of come to mind. Like, I lift my eyes to the mountains, and it sounds like this is just kind of like a happy psalm reflecting on all the wonderful things in life. But if we just take a step back and we just really consider what's going on here, there are a whole lot of things that do not make sense if the mood is just happy, feel good. I mean, just there in verse 3, he will not let your foot slip, is only a comfort to somebody who feels like they're stumbling through life, to someone who's already familiar with uncertainty and instability. The promise that your guardian will not slumber is only reassuring to somebody who's been in that place of wondering, where are you, God? Don't you see what's happening to me? And don't get me wrong, yes, when we find ourselves in places where life is pretty much good, we can and we should give thanks that the Lord has protected us from things that would otherwise throw a damper in our day and put us in distress. But this psalm is for the people who are actually in distress, who know exactly what it's like to be there. You know, one of the things about being in such a small church is you hear what's going on with people. You know, you hear about people who are struggling to get through to some of their family members. Or you hear about people who maybe have just lost a loved one. You hear about people who are basically always in physical pain. You know, you hear about people with, you know, just deep, unanswered tragedies from years, decades back that they never really got a good explanation for, like, why did that have to happen? You hear about people who maybe are struggling in their experience of church even, and you know, they feel a weight on their spirit rather than being lifted up in a place that they thought was to help, to facilitate their communion with God. And none of that takes away from the joys. None of that takes away from the friends that you have praying for you or the newborn children that are added to our church family. But they do make you wonder. They do make you ask the question, did the same God who gave me this give me that too? Or even more discouraging, did the same God who gave them that wonderful thing give me this cross to bear? And, you know, maybe none of those examples quite hit home for you. Here's one. Maybe in the events of recent years, weeks, days, maybe it's just that basic, very logical human reaction of, I don't think I can trust those people who took an oath to protect, to uphold, to preserve law and order in my home country. If you're tracking with me now, aren't these the things that make us wonder, where is our help coming from? Where are you? God, what is your plan for all of this? Now, if you're looking at your Bible there, you'll notice that before Psalm 121 actually starts in verse 1, most of your translations probably have a little note that says, a song of ascents. And this psalm is actually one of 15 psalms there. It's Psalms 120 through Psalm 134, and these 15 songs are called the Songs of Ascents, and each one has that little note there at the beginning, and actually it's a part of the original writing of the psalm. And so what this indicates is that when you're reading one of these songs, you are reading one of the songs that the people in ancient Israel would sing as they were gathering from around the world to meet in Jerusalem and to ascend up the mountain where the temple was located. And the temple was just extraordinary. Just imagine what you think of when you think of heaven. You think of rejoicing? Do you think of gratitude? Do you think of everybody having what they need? Do you think of everybody having their needs met? Do you think of feasting? Do you think of closeness to God? That is what the temple was like. Gold everywhere, people singing, dancing for joy, a huge treasury where the funds were rightly used to ensure that everybody had enough. The temple was purposely designed in every way to be on earth as it is in heaven. And so the idea is that as you ascended up the Temple Mountain, you were ascending to where God is. You were getting closer and closer to God and to heaven. Now, I really don't like to get into the Hebrew and get into the original languages unless you absolutely have to, partly because I myself struggle to keep track of things at times, but I couldn't help but notice that this psalm in particular is spelled a little bit differently from the other 14 songs of ascents. See, while the other 14 psalms begin a song of ascents, this one in Hebrew begins a song to the ascents. In other words, the songs of ascents are designed to prepare your heart for worship, but this one, this is a song to the people who are actually doing the ascending. This song is to the people who are being lifted up. This is a song to the ascenders. Psalm 121 is about to tell us what kind of life is available for the one whose heart is set on ascending to the Creator. That the Christian life is not about the burden that is placed on you to do the ascending, to perform the ascending, but that it's about a God who promises to lift you up. This kind of ascent that we're talking about is the kind where we are raised beyond what we are and what we know life to be to a level that we can never be taken back down from. Christ follower, please know that what is available to you in Christ is an elevated quality of life that no power on earth can suppress. I mean, just compare this idea of ascent, of being lifted up, to Obadiah chapter 1. All those who were once strangers and exiles will take back the land that was theirs. And watch what verse 21 says. All those who have been saved will go up to Mount Zion and judge the mountains of Esau. So what's going on here? Because Obadiah, you know, he's using this prophetic imagery and these metaphors that don't immediately make sense. We will judge the mountains of Esau, meaning that all the earthly kingdoms, all the earthly things that once made us fearful, the things that once had power over us, will lose their power because the life that we have now is of a higher order. Friends, we are about to sing a song about the level to which that we have been raised, which is why the beginning of verse 1 is frankly puzzling, confusing. I lift my eyes to the mountains. Now, the rabbis, these ancient Jewish teachers, know that to lift up one's eyes is the natural response of somebody who is in distress, yearning for a kind of intervention and deliverance. But this psalm is not a psalm of wallowing in our despair. This verse can just as easily be read, I will lift my eyes. I will raise my viewpoint to see what's ahead of me. Notice how big of a difference that subtle change actually does make. The psalm is not just about how to narrowly get through suffering by the skin of your teeth. It's not just about how to get through it all and you just barely keep your head above water. But I will lift my eyes means that this psalm tells us how we can proactively and victoriously respond anytime I am in distress going forward. So what kind of distress is this psalm responding to? And how is it that distress and pain have a place in this elevated kind of life? And what are the mountains that we are to lift our eyes to? The mountains actually here have kind of a double meaning. And the two meanings kind of at first seem to be in conflict with each other. Interestingly enough, the mountains are both a symbol for this new kind of life, and they are the reason that this psalm is not just a happy feel-good moment, right? The mountains are a place where both wonderful and terrible things can happen. People who have been through the mountains are no stranger to anguish and distress in their lives. You know, normally, like I said, we think of mountains. We think of, you know, the picturesque landscape with this beautiful scenery. We imagine just kind of like a breathtaking view and the awe and wonder of seeing everything below from the very top. Anybody here ever been hiking in the mountains? I should see a lot more hands because if I'm the outdoorsy one, I mean. And so, you know, it's kind of the thing where for us it's like, wow, I got to get a picture of this, you know, just how wonderful the view is. And this could not be further from how these poor travelers making their way to Jerusalem thought about these mountains. Much to the contrary of how we tend to think of the mountains, these mountains in particular that these travelers had to navigate were known to be a place where gangs of robbers and looters would hide out. In fact, even dangerous wild animals would be there lurking for them. Everywhere that you turned, you had to have your guard up. Everywhere that you looked, you had to be aware. In fact, these mountains are the exact kind of setting that Jesus has in mind when he tells the story of the Good Samaritan. He says, a man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho, which is through the hill country. So you can kind of imagine this man coming from Jerusalem. He's actually probably leaving some kind of festival at the temple. He was probably worshiping there. And now instead of ascending, he's going back down home where he came from. A man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho when he was attacked by robbers. They stripped him of his clothes. They beat him. They went away, leaving him half dead. And this story is all too familiar to the people hearing it because they knew what kind of dangers the mountains would bring. The mountains represent uncertainty, doubt, having to fend for yourself, being left in the dark. All of these troubling human experiences. The mountains were the place that you looked when you were afraid and you had no idea what was coming. If we could maybe put the mountains in our own words, if we could use contemporary examples, suddenly I lift my eyes to the mountains sounds a lot like as I look to that report from my last doctor's visit, as I look to the results of that election, as I look at the rising cost of literally everything, food, gas, as I look for something to fill the void that's in my heart. And honestly, it's not even always about us. Sometimes we feel this for other people. You know, as I look to my child who's having a hard time in church. We even have people here in our church who serve in the ministry over at the jail. Talk about uncertainty. You know, as I look to these people who really want to make a change and turn their lives around, but boy, do they have a long uphill climb ahead of them if they ever want to integrate themselves back into society. Notice how quickly this psalm has gotten very personal. And notice that the God-sustained life that this psalm has to offer you is not one of just, you know, sticking your head in the sand, pretending like the things going on around you and the fears that are up ahead aren't there. But if we could just zoom out a little bit, because the mountains are not just about the dangers of traveling through life. The mountains actually end up being one of the most significant places and one of the most significant themes in the entire Old Testament. In fact, even in the Gospels, just think, where is Jesus always found praying? Where does the devil take Jesus for the third and final temptation? Where is Jesus when he gives probably his most famous sermon, message, whatever you want to call it? I mean, it's literally named after the mountain. In fact, even when he's crucified up on a hill, and there's almost certainly some kind of connection there. And this is because throughout the Old Testament, the writers are using a Jewish method of storytelling that's called the principle of first mention. And so it's kind of like this, if you can feature, maybe if you and your family ever take like an annual family vacation, something kind of like that. Yeah, you keep going back to the same place. And you keep going back to the same location for your trip. But along the way, you make different memories and you add new memories to the same spot over and over again over time. And maybe you meet different people each time that you're down there. And it's kind of like that. The same kind of thing is happening with the mountains in the Old Testament. You see, time and time again, the authors keep building on and adding more and more history and religious meaning to their understanding of the mountains. For one, the mountains always have a special kind of spiritual significance. If you can feature, the higher up you are, it was thought that you were closer to God and to heaven. This is why the temple is always on a high mountain, and even the non-Jewish nations that came before Israel believed this. They built all their altars and temples on these mountains. But then you have all these stories. You see, in Genesis, the ark comes to rest on a mountain, but only after the entire world has literally fallen apart in a flood. And then you have Abraham, who's fully convinced that he is going to lose his son and that he's going to be the one to have to kill him, who meets God on the mountain. David, who basically saves the people of God from a foreign military invasion, fights a giant down in the valley between two mountains with the Philistines and the Israelite army on opposite sides. And time again, these stories, all the way to the destruction of the Temple Mountain by Babylon, these people wondering, will we ever get back to our home, feeling the agony of their mistakes, suffering from what they thought was the distance from God and how far off that he felt in the wake of the decisions that they had made. All of this is wrapped up in, I lift my eyes to the mountains. More simply, the mountains are a place of tremendous spiritual significance, but they do not always feel like you are on top of the world. The mountains speak to those areas of life where we've seen God show up. Maybe he's done it once for us before. We've seen him do it for somebody else. And in our heads, we know that he can do it, but in our hearts, our confidence is shaken. We don't see a way out. We're desperately looking for any help we can get. But hear me, these are the most spiritually significant times in our lives, the times that are most ripe for us to be lifted up and to more deeply experience the goodness of God. I mean, isn't it interesting that all of these stories of people, I mean, good, faithful people in distress, faced with some great challenge or disaster, whether they were experiencing loss and tragedy or their world was literally falling apart, these are stories of God meeting them on the mountain. And it was these kinds of times, times where help couldn't come from you, times when help couldn't come from what you had saved up, from the people that you knew, who was in your circle, when help couldn't come from how well you were managing things. It was in these moments that the people of God, for thousands of years of faithful promise-keeping, came to the boast of verse 2. My help comes from the Lord, the maker of heaven and earth. And notice that the verse doesn't just say that the Lord made heaven and earth, that creation was something that happened way back then. It was kind of like a one-time event, and God just kind of, you know, hands off, like, let's see how this thing goes. But that the Lord is the maker, the ongoing, everlasting sustainer, the one who is constantly renewing things in the world. Literally, the word there for maker is the Lord does heaven and earth. The Lord is the doer of all things that exist. The power to be, the power of life is God. The power of life itself, of never-ending possibilities. And that God is for you. As sure as God sustains the cosmos is how sure you are that your help is coming. If God made creation for your enjoyment, if God made creation and graciously put his goodness into all things as the canvas of his love, if God made this place as your home, won't he so keep you in his faithful care to ensure that you can find rest in it? There is absolutely no reason for God to create anything unless he was concerned for it and was intimately involved with it. And because of that, all that goes on in creation is the unfolding of his purposes. Every passing moment is loaded with the possibility of God revealing himself to you in new ways. And it's this possibility, this potential to be drawn deeper into the goodness of God that is the heartbeat of this psalm. Did you notice that at no point does the psalm say, God, would you please remove the mountains? Did you notice that at no point does the psalm ask even for a different route so they could avoid the danger? But instead, that the psalm rejoices because we know God's creative power is going to be on display. The psalm rejoices in his creativity because a creative person is always up to something new. The story is not over. The final word has not been spoken. The best is always yet to come for his people. Yes, God's power can rescue you out of terrible situations, but his creativity always has something new for you on the other side of your suffering. His creativity is what gives you the courage that you didn't already have to face uncertainty. Hear me on this, Christ follower. All the promises of Psalm 121 hinge on the creativity of God that he so generously pours over us. That he doesn't hold back with giving us what we need to be sustained. That the courage that comes from him to live and to be in the face of danger is what gives us the strength to say, I lift up my eyes to the mountains. Not, I accidentally saw the mountains. Not, I was forced to look at the danger up ahead. Not, I tried to look, but I couldn't keep myself from worrying. But that I proactively look my distress in the face, confident in the sustaining care of God. Now, Lord willing, I'll be back up here sometime in July, and we'll be able to tease out the rest of the promises in verse 2 through 8. But let me encourage you that you don't need to live in verse 1, right? Because sometimes, you know, I just want to camp out in verse 1. Like, let me tell you, I can set up shop in verse 1. You know, sometimes all I want to do is just to look up ahead and fixate on what's troubling me. But the elevated life that we are talking about that God has for us is so much more than the fretfulness of verse 1. How is this need going to be met? How is this need going to be addressed? How is this going to be taken care of? And so friends, let me invite you forward into verse 2, and let me invite you to see how even the fretfulness of verse 1 can be turned into blessing. Because oftentimes, the worrying and the anxiety and the distress that comes our way is an opportunity for us to evaluate where we are actually getting our help from and what areas of life God can reveal his faithfulness to us anew. You see, suffering and instability will always test us and show us where our foundation is solid versus what areas of life we are dependent on some other person, some other institution, some other political figure, or maybe our own giftings. And that is a blessing because none of those things are built to carry the weight of life, and neither are we. Now, the challenge for us is that if someone were to ask us where our confidence is, We know the right answer. Like, if someone was asking you, we know to say, well, of course my trust is in the Lord. But oftentimes, what we know to be the right answer prevents us from seeing what is actually true for us. Oftentimes, what we know to be the correct principle hides from us what is functionally true in our lives. There's a story of a children's Sunday school teacher. This is somewhere else, not here. And they're playing some kind of game. I don't know what it is. But the teacher asks, okay, kids, what's small, brown, has a big bushy tail, and eats acorns? And immediately, one of the kids' hands shot up, and he said, teacher, I know the answer is probably Jesus, but that sure sounds a lot like a squirrel to me. And you know, it's funny, and it's a cute story, but this story really is an image of something that is so true for me, and maybe you can relate, that it is often the case that what I know the answer should be stops me from reflecting on what I actually look to when I need help. Because the place that you run to first, the place that is your first inclination to go when you are under pressure, is the place that you have put your confidence. You know, I'm not just saying, you know, you say a couple prayers and like magic, everything goes away. You know, you look at Jesus even there in the garden before he's getting arrested. That is not a man who read Jeremiah 29:11 and said, everything's going to be good now. That's a man who is in anguish, but with confidence to go before what was ahead of him. Let me exhort you that the meditations of your mind and the thoughts that you think on repeat set the course for what you will feel and believe about everything. That the things that you fix your mind on will greatly determine the narratives that your soul is fed in the silence of the night. May we be intentional in our care for our souls and the voices that we allow ourselves to listen to. I lift up my eyes to the mountains. From where does my help come from? My help comes from the Lord, the maker of heaven and earth. He will not let your foot slip. He who watches over you will not slumber. Indeed, he who watches over Israel will neither slumber nor sleep. The Lord watches over you. The Lord is your shade at your right hand. The sun will not harm you by day, nor the moon by night. The Lord will keep you from all harm. He will watch over your life. The Lord will watch over your coming and your going, both now and forevermore. The easiest promise I can make you, I guarantee you, if you are in distress, this is a time when God is going to come to see you soon. And his creative power will always rewrite the ending. Let us pray. Father, I thank you for your sustaining care, Lord, the care that you have over us that we can be so confident in, Lord, that we can look our distress in the face, but Lord, that we are not bound to just looking and just beholding the things that are troubling to us, Lord, but that we are invited forward into verse 2 in this open acknowledgement that my help comes from the Lord who made heaven and earth. If he can handle sustaining the cosmos, I think he can handle sustaining me in the problems that I face. And Lord, the problems are real. There's no denying that sometimes we wonder as the people of God, how can we go through, seems like sometimes we get the worst of it. Lord, I ask that that confidence would be something that you allow us to grab onto, Lord. Lord, I pray that you would propel us, that you would encourage us, that you would embolden us in our faith, Lord, and that, Lord, may we not trust in anything. May we not, even for a second, think that stockpiling more of the things we think we lack is the answer, Lord. But, Lord, I just pray that you would meet us. I pray that you would show up for us in big ways, Lord, but ultimately that it would be our confidence in you that anchors us to our solid foundation in Jesus Christ. Lord, I ask all of these things in your name. Amen.